It is our pleasure, Bill Russell and I, Paula Gordon, to be with Alan Alda. The many things that you have played over the many years have included a surprising number of senators and would-be president. I found that very interesting that over the course of time, I keep seeing you showing up in political roles. Now, you do really well until you get in front of my home state of Illinois' legislature, at which point... The political part of life is important to you, even if you don't talk politics, isn't it?
Well, you know, one of the main reasons I think that I get hired to play politicians is that I look better in a suit than a loincloth. And so there are, you know, only a certain number of parts for people in a suit.
What were you in a loincloth, please?
Never. That's what that sort of gives you a hint.
That was the agent you fired.
No, but... I try to play in pieces that I find interesting and that sound like fun. You know, sound like some kind of, usually a kind of a serious kind of fun. But that's there's all kinds of fun. But I don't have some plan about picking parts that I'm in. I don't see how you can. The only plan I have is I don't want to make a movie that I wouldn't want to go see. Because why would I spend 2 or 3 months making a movie that I wouldn't spend an hour on, you know?
Or that I wouldn't spend an hour on.
It's up to you what you see. but as far as I'm concerned, I don't want to have to sit through some of these things I get offered.
You know? Good taste. When I use the example of the Beatles, I didn't do that lightly in this story about the kid who didn't know that Paul McCartney had been in a band before Wings. MASH was really important to my generation. And yes, it was about the Korean MASH units. And yes, that was a moment in time. But for those of us for whom the Vietnam era was our coming of age, it's just impossible to overstate how important it was to see real people, or at least real people playing real people, in circumstances that were very raw, and very funny, and helped, I think, teach a whole generation of us that in the midst of great pain, there could be laughter. Laughter really key to an awful lot of life? You'll forgive my saying, but since you talk about life in two volumes, I don't hesitate to ask you that.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I it's sort of become a cliche to say that laughter is important in life. I think it is. I think it's, but you know, it's very interesting. In almost every war, a lot of jokes come out of the military. The funny sayings, funny takes on things. Especially I remember out of World War II, there was a whole vocabulary that was funny. That came out of people being put under pressure like that. And I think that probably is an example of how the harrowing and the funny can get mixed. In fact, they kind of have to get mixed. Mm-hmm. Some of the funniest laughs, some of the biggest laughs you'll have is at a funeral.
Yeah.
People, when the explosive laughter that occurs when somebody reminds everybody else of some of the foibles of the dead person, it's with affection. And they're so glad to be able to release that tension that there's usually an explosive laugh that comes out, or at the wake afterwards, or the shiva. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of fond laughter, or sometimes naughty laughter, and it's a great relief to people to be able to do that.
You're talking in your last book, particularly a great deal about living.
Mm-hmm.
And how to live, some of the tricks that you've found and discovered and shared, and some that have worked and some that haven't worked. But it seems right at the center of that is the notion of being present.
Yeah.
And one of the, you know, the kinds of intense experiences, whether it's war, funerals tend to do that, mm-hmm. Lots of different kinds of things that sort of focus us in ways that other events don't. It's like a good hanging. It requires your attention. But it seems that focus and that the engagement in the world around us has been central to the work you've tried to do, and central to your view of how we can perhaps do a little better job of living the lives we live.
Well, I really have tried very hard not to tell people how I think they should live.
Right.
And that's why the whole, you know, like the things I overheard while talking to myself, is a book about me trying to figure out the meaning of my own life. And I think it's maybe entertaining to watch some poor schlep try to figure this out when it's a quixotic effort. You know, it's not that easy. But it's not to tell other people what to do. But one of the solutions that I came to, you're right, is as you say, being present, being aware, noticing my life as it happens. Because I found that there's not much point in how much meaning my life has if I don't notice it. At least there's not much point, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. I suppose you could do great works and never notice your life passing by, and then other people would benefit from it. But I'm a little greedier than that.
It's not your skill set.
That's not for me. I want to notice it. I want to enjoy the process, because this is all I got. I mean, I don't expect to go on after this. So I want to make sure that on this side of eternity, I get a feeling of some pleasure in life. There's nothing. I mean, what could be better than life? I can't imagine anything better than life.
Thinking of that, listening to you say that, it reminds me of E.O. Wilson, the biologist, great biologist, the ant scientist, talking about the living a life in a Magellanic voyage around a tree trunk.
Say that again.
A Magellan voyage around a tree trunk. Attending... That there is so much going on
that's a great phrase.
Attend to all the things, the life and the...
And he said you wouldn't be done at the end of your life going around that tree.
The thing is that it really is true. Again, this has been said so many times it starts to lose some of its own meaning. But there really is a universe in a speck of dust, in the sense that with our minds, or at least with my mind, I could never get to the bottom of it. No matter how long I explored it, because there are so many questions within questions. Every time you open a door, it turns out there's another 100 doors you have to figure out how to break the locks of. I mean, every mystery introduces us to another 100 mysteries. That's why it always amazes me that... And just the other day, somebody raised this question when I was talking to a group of people about this book. Somebody said, "Well, do you think that science leaves out mystery too much?"
And whoops!
Yeah.
They asked you that.
Yeah. The thing is, I mean, it's not that science replaces mystery with knowledge or some intellectual, crisp, killing, slicing and dicing. Every time a mystery is explored. And we think we understand that mystery better. There's 100 new mysteries. So science is not a way of eliminating mystery. It's a way of producing more. And we'll never. I don't know if we'll ever get to the bottom. Why should we ever? I mean, already we're starting to think about a multiverse and
10 to the 500th universes. Yeah. Let's see.
According to some string theorists, and that's a lot. That's many.
Bigger than a bread box.
That's right.
That's a series that would go on for a long time.
Cornel West talks about the African-American experience bringing what he calls tragicomic hope into the American culture, if you will. And I guess I think about that as you're talking about what's funny, how do you get through the tough times. I also think about that in terms of Cornel West, Dr. West, being very explicit that tragicomic hope, which is kind of the business that you're in, the Greeks, with their sense of dialogue, the Socratic tradition, and then the Hebrew tradition that demands justice, that he thinks that's where we come together as an American culture. It seems to me that you have, let's see, that'd be too many toes, but do you have enough toes that you can get them in all three of those puddles?
Well, my toes are awash with all of that stuff, but not always consciously. But I think that partly because I think he's right, that as you describe it, he's talking about sources to the hope we have for ourselves that go way back, a hope for justice and a hope for connection and some kind of freedom. But it's very interesting when you talk about a tragic comic approach to to life. It's both. I notice when as I move among black people and as I move among Jews, I get a very similar thing. There's so much energy. There's so much sweetness and connection. It's one of the first things I notice when a stranger comes up to me who happens to be black. And the same thing with Jews, no matter how much they've been through, they can laugh, they can find humor in it. I once was sitting next to Simon Wiesenthal, and he was telling me a joke, and he loves jokes. Somebody came up to him who we hadn't seen since he'd been in a concentration camp with him. And the guy introduced himself, and they just talked for a few seconds. And then the man said, "Well, I just wanted to say hello," and he left. And when he left, Wiesenthal had tears running down his face. And he turned back to me with the tears running down his face and finished the joke. That, to me, was an image not only of his particular strength, but also the strength of a people who have been oppressed for a long, long time. And the same thing with black people. I think it may be a very adaptive response to the hard times that the rest of the world gives you, to find humor and softness and connection, when it would be so much easier to be angry and bitter. And even if you are angry and bitter, it's a way to defuse your own anger, I think. It's a wonderful trait, but maybe it comes up spontaneously. Maybe it's a human trait that we manage to get through hard times with.
I wonder, I've heard a number of people over the years say that you don't learn from the good times, it's the bad times you learn from.
I know, I've heard that a lot. I don't know.
I don't like it much
either.
That's a lot more like broccoli again.
Could we pick on spinach?
I love broccoli.
I was
going to
say.
I think you're lucky if you like broccoli. People who don't like it are, you know, probably not getting to eat something healthy. But I happen to like it. But I think I learned from good times a lot. I mean, I want those good times to go on. I want to know how I got there. If I'm in a performance, if I'm acting in a play, I think I learn a lot more from the moments that click than I do from the moments where I forget my lines or I do it in a clumsy, mechanical way. Those are regrettable moments. Regrettable things you can learn from. I think that you can't have a play without regrettable behavior on the part of the characters. Somebody has to do something regrettable or you don't have a play. So there is something engaging about these mistakes we make. But I learned a lot from having good times fall on me.
Well, and that's a lot of what friends are about, isn't it? I mean, that's why you need to be careful.
Friends explain to you how rotten you are.
Well,
in the nicest
keeps you
possible
informed.
Way.
Well, we'll stay away from the rotten when we come back with Alan Alda, Bill Russell. I, Paula Gordon, be with us when we return.